Whitley Strieber is well known to listeners of this program. He's the author of more than 20 best-selling books, including the blockbuster Communion. He co-wrote Superstorm with Art Bell, that led to the film The Day After Tomorrow. He has, as you know, persisted as a what he calls a supporter of alternative concepts through his Unknown Country website. He's got this new book out, The Key. Actually, it's not new. It came out in an earlier version, but this new version, I think, is much more powerful. The Key, A True Encounter, and it is a mind bender. I think, in my view, it is more profound, more unsettling even than Communion, which says a lot. We'll take our break and come right back with Whitley Strieber here on Coast to Coast AM. I've had the pleasure of interviewing Whitley Strieber a couple of times over the years, including, as I mentioned earlier in the broadcast, the first time back in 1989 via satellite. And every time I've talked to him, every time I've heard him, every time I've read one of his books, he always leaves me with something profound, at least one nugget that sticks in my head. I remember that first interview in 1989, Whitley telling me, you talk about UFO secrecy. The government is not the true architect of UFO secrecy. The visitors, whoever they are the architects of UFO secrecy. And that always stuck with me and tempered my own coverage of the UFO cover-up issues over the years. Whitley, it's really great to have you on the program.
Well, George, it's exciting to be back with you. It's been too long, and I remember that interview very well back in 1989, and I still hold to that theory because I think that they must be. Otherwise, they would land. They would walk out in the middle of a street or land on literally on the White House lawn, but that doesn't happen. Therefore, they have to be in agreement about the secrecy. They have to be.
Well, in your new book, The Key, you get into some discussion of what their possible motives for maintaining the secrecy are, and we'll get into that. But I want to start this way, is that, I realize that in this crazy field, you have your share of detractors. We all do. There are folks who figure, well, Whitley Strieber is a talented novelist. He approaches this UFO stuff, these ghosts and other things, just like a novel and makes it all up. And, for purposes of our discussion tonight, I'm starting with the willing suspension of disbelief position. We'll talk later about challenges to whether or not this really happened or not. But I always think that you're such an important thinker in this field, this weird world of esoteric and unusual stuff. Whether we take it with a grain of salt or whether we consider everything you write as being literally true, and I think that is true of this book, which I find, as I said in the introduction, to be more profound, more unsettling than Communion.
Well, I think in this particular case, I would say that in most of my other books, including Communion, I've never been absolutely sure where the line is between facts and and perception. In other words, I can describe what I saw and felt, but I can't tell you that's what happened. And all I can say is that I've always tried to be as accurate as possible in describing my perceptions. In this case, it's in one particular way quite, or in two ways, it's quite different. The first one is the man I met seemed pretty normal. He was there. He knocked on the door of a hotel room. I was in Toronto at the time, and
June 6, 1998, right?
Right. I had been on an author tour, a long author tour for the book called Confirmation, and I had dinner and in the room and had gone to sleep. And the tray was still on the little desk in the room that with the dinner things on it. There came a knock at the door, and I assumed it was room service. I didn't realize how long I'd actually been asleep, and I went over and opened the door. And this guy came in, and he was it looked like he was in his 70s, and he was not unusual looking. I've described him in different ways, and but basically he was a short but not terribly short person. And he was maybe 5'5 to 5'8, I would say. He was rather slightly built. He didn't look at all threatening, in other words. My initial reaction after some confusion about the dinner tray, was to try to get him out, because, you know, you'd think that anybody who would pop into your room in the middle of the night is not going to be good news.
And you've had some adventures like that on book tours, I know.
Oh, yeah. I had a lady who apparently paid off some idiot in a hotel in Chicago to get into my room, and I came in exhausted after a late night radio or television show, I forget which, and I was taking off my clothes and suddenly realized there was another person in the room. Apparently she'd stepped back into the closet while I walked in, and, you know, I got her out easily enough, but it was really upsetting, and it could have been dangerous. I mean, you just don't know what might happen in a moment like that.
You've got groupies.
Well, I didn't get a good enough look at her to know whether she was a groupie or somebody. I just don't know what it was about, but I got her out of there. That's the end of the story. And I left that hotel that morning and never went back. I went to another hotel. So it had happened before, and yeah, I was aware of that. And I had let this guy in, but then he started talking, and it was interesting. I had to admit, he said some things that I had never heard before. And, you know, he said a few things at first that I really didn't notice much. And I'm pretty sure I remembered what they were, a couple of sentences.
But you asked him, hey, who are you, right?
Well, it not at first. No, I didn't. Initially, I thought he was the room service waiter, and then he started in with these philosophical statements, and I sort of said, I asked him, you know, I responded to them because they were unusual enough to sort of make me stop. I did not initially ask him who he was. No, I thought he was a fan. I didn't think. You know, I didn't really, his identity wasn't a question. It was obvious that what he was. I mean, you know, he was someone from one of the book signings or something. But then he said something very peculiar about the Holocaust. He said that we were meant to have the ability to leave the planet in mass by now, but we're trapped here because the child who would have been born, who would have understood how gravity works, would have cracked the mystery of gravity, was never born because his parents died in the Holocaust. And I never heard anything quite like that before. It was a very unusual statement. True or not, I don't know. I reacted to it not that it, you know, with saying, oh my, that's really true, but more, how unusual, what an unusual idea. I never heard anyone say anything like that before. It was like he had some kind of inner knowledge of the way the world worked, of a kind that you don't ever come across. And the guy spoke with what I would describe as authority. He had a gentle voice, but a quick voice. And at that point, I started in with the questions, and later on, I did begin to realize as this was going on that, you know, I really needed to find out who this was, and I began to question him about himself, and he was very circumspect and not very helpful. He at one point said he was a Canadian, but he didn't pay taxes, which turned out to be the only really good clue I ever got, because Canadians, yes, any Canadian, they have definitely got taxes to pay, and everybody in Canada pays taxes, but not all of the native tribes do. Some of them are exempt from taxation. And I went down that road fairly far after. What happened was that when I woke up the next morning, I had even taken a few notes during the conversation. So first I looked for the notes, and they were there, and, you know, it was obvious it didn't really occur to me that it hadn't happened. It obviously had happened. But the content of it was so extraordinary, as I remembered it, that I called my wife and I said to her, Ann, you know, I had this very unusual thing happen last night. This man came in, and I explained what had happened and said, I'm going to blow this off. You know, she knows me. And I said to her, I'm telling you to not let me do that, because I really do need to write down what this guy said. And, of course, by the time I gotten home, I figured I was just some nut, you know, and I told her, forget it. It was ridiculous. She said, no, you called me, you told me this, and don't blow it off. You want to sit down and write these notes out and get a put this together. I started trying to find out more about who he was. I'd asked around about him a little bit before I left the hotel, and I saw the publicist that morning again, and I asked her about it. Him, tried to describe him, couldn't get anywhere. But there is a tribe, a very interesting and wonderful tribe in Newfoundland called the Mi'kmaqs. And there is something about them. They have an appearance that would suggest the possibility that they're partly Europeans. And what's interesting is that there is a legend, and there are a few enigmatic ruins in northern Newfoundland that suggest this legend may be true, that John Sinclair, the leader of the Templars in Scotland, at the time that the Templars were destroyed and Jacques de Molay, the Grand Master of the Templars, was killed, actually came to Canada many 200 years before Columbus came to America, and founded a colony in Newfoundland, and they might have interbred with these people. They might also have brought extraordinary knowledge of some sort. And I thought maybe that was where it came from, but I couldn't get anywhere. In other words, he didn't look like these people at all. I mean, he looked much more Caucasian. And I didn't get anywhere. That I got involved to an extent with some of the Templars in Canada. There's a Templar masonry still in Canada, and I think they may know this man and may know who he is, but I was never able to pin that down, unfortunately. I worked on this for 2 years. Then I finally published that. By that time, I had written everything out and gotten it all pretty well put together.
Let's back up for a second. The guy comes in your room. He starts telling you things that he probably, you can't understand how he knows them. You start asking him questions. Are you taking notes during this? And are you literally writing everything down? Or were you able to? No. Okay.
I have a pretty good memory. And I take mnemonic notes. In other words, I'll take a note that just says, a couple of words maybe here and there. And I can always pretty well put together. I've always been able to do this since I was in school. I would put together sometimes the note just a little symbol, or it'll be two words, and I can really put it together pretty well from that.
Your own shorthand. I understand.
Yeah, sure. I'm comfortable with that, and that's how I did it.
You thought initially, your first impression, your memory was the guy was there for about a half an hour, and then you realize as you write all this stuff out, he had to have been there longer than that.
Well, no, not really. I don't think he was there for more than 45 minutes, maybe an hour. It's not that long a conversation. I didn't get the impression he was there for hours. And I don't think I've ever said that either. I may have, but I got the impression that he was there for about 45 minutes.
That was the initial impression, and then you wrote later, you thought he might have, looking at all the material, I know there's a pretty good pile of material here that you thought he might have been.
He might have been. I mean, I don't know, but... if you read it out, the reading of it takes about 45 minutes. So,
okay.
So I just don't know. I didn't zero in on that because I was more interested in trying to get the words right and to get what he said right than I was figuring out, the ins and outs of how long it. I did ask the front desk what their policy was when people came in the night to visit someone, and they said, well, we don't call our guests after midnight, and we certainly don't let we don't give out a guest's room number, and certainly not after midnight. And they're pretty adamant about it, and I'm sure that's true. However, I've been living in this world long enough to know that the $20 bill goes a far piece in a hotel, and it could have been very easy for him to find me. He knew I was in that hotel in the first place. And that's another story, how he would have known that. He would have had to have been somehow connected with the publisher. That's why I asked publicist. You know, I described him and asked if there was anyone in the publishing company that looked like that. And she couldn't pin anybody down. And I don't think it's not a big, it was a Canadian publisher, and you know, there was not a big office, about 12 people in it, she said. And so I don't think he was. She certainly didn't think so.
Back to this thing about the Holocaust, which really got your attention. He says something to the effect that it was the darkest period of human history of the last eon or whatever, the last age, of
yeah,
the last 2,000 years.
2,000 years.
Not only because of the destruction of 6 million people and the horrors of the camps, but also because of the intellectual capabilities of the people who were wiped out and their children.
Well, right. They were very capable people. That's why... You know, the Jews in Germany were under 2% of the population. They were almost invisible, or should have been, but they weren't. And the reason was that even though they were under 2% of the population, they controlled more than 20% of the wealth in the country. That made them very visible, especially in a country where everybody was starving, which was true at that time. And so these people had been very efficient and very effective in establishing themselves, and most of them, many, many people in Germany during World War II and before World War II in the 30s, first discovered that they were Jews when the authorities knocked on their door to arrest them. They didn't even know it. They were secularized and completely integrated into the society. So, but obviously, I'm not saying they were necessarily racially more intelligent, but these were very well educated, upper level people for the most part. So yeah, there was a loss there when they were taken out of the society and taken out of the world. There was a significant loss.
Including this loss of a technology or a development that would allow us to escape the planet. This guy suggesting that he knew what would come in the future.
Right. This loss of this child, the child that was never born, gravity has been an enigma to mankind, to human science, for a long time. We have barely begun to be able to detect gravity waves, and we don't quite know what gravity is even now. We haven't been able to make much progress on this, but if you could understand gravity, then you would be able to do something conceivably, like create an ever-accelerating machine that would continue to accelerate in space as long as you wanted it to, and therefore would reach speeds that would make it possible for it to actually get to other stars in terms of the time passing on the ship in far less than a single lifetime. Of course, at home, because of the way the physics of relativity works, much more time would pass. But the faster you went on the device, the less time would pass compared to the amount of distance you covered. You could really spread out into the stars if you had this knowledge. And here we are now, too many of us trapped on this planet, nearly 7 billion of us. I think there's been something like 108 billion human beings have ever lived on Earth. And we are using this place up. That's why we're having so much economic trouble right now. Whenever the economy starts to grow, prices start to go up because everything immediately starts to become scarce again, rare earths and so forth. And then the growth stops because the costs go up too much. And so we need to get out of here. We need to go beyond Earth, and not with old-fashioned rockets.
We need We need to take a break here right now. Sorry to interrupt you right there. Whitley Strieber, author of the book, The Key, A True Encounter. When we come back, a discussion of our place in the universe as described by this mysterious visitor in a Canadian hotel room. Stay with us here on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Whitley Strieber, author of a new book, and it's also an old book. It's called The Key, A True Encounter. When we come back, we jump right into the heart of this, this strange encounter with an odd man in a hotel room in Canada, and some of the very unsettling but yet profound things that he conveyed to Whitley Strieber. Stay with us here on Coast to Coast AM. Whitley Strieber, this guy in the hotel room starts telling you things, unusual things, about humans, about our place in the universe. Let's start this way. What does he tell you about other intelligent life in the universe?
Well, that certainly not a lot. Certainly didn't talk about that as much as he talked about us. But he did imply that it is not simply in the physical form, but that there is what he called conscious energy, which I thought was a really interesting idea and one that is beginning to, like so many of the things the guy said. This is one of the reasons I waited 10 years before publishing this book in a big way. I published it sort of privately on my website. One of the reasons I waited 10 years is he made a lot of predictions, George, and I wanted to see what happened to him. In any case, there is in terms of the soul, a man named Stuart Hameroff, who is studying the soul. He's the director for consciousness studies at the University of Arizona. He's an anesthesiologist and also a colleague of a very famous and extraordinary physicist called Roger Penrose. And he is beginning to suggest that that the soul could survive as quantum information in the universe after the death of the body. And the Master of the Key did predict that one of the things we would eventually come to understand is this soul, and the implication was that once we came into contact with conscious energy, once there was a two-way communication, that things would change here dramatically. And I think that his implication was that a lot of other species, maybe physical species like us, have gotten already to that point. And once they get to that point, they come to a sort of singularity where their minds move beyond space and time, and they become something quite different from what they had been. And in a sense, our journey toward that is what the key is probably all at its core all about.
And he's trying to tell us we need to get on with it, that so far we're a little bit of a disappointment, right? We're not like other species elsewhere that have attained this level.
I wouldn't say it was the implication that we were a disappointment, more that we were in danger. And like one of the things that came out of it was he made some statements about ice ages and climate change that really changed my life, and because what I did was, the first thing after I'd gotten the conversation all transcribed is I started going through the various scientific statements he'd made. And most of them were, quite frankly, not anywhere at that time in the scientific literature. They just weren't there. But I did find, by looking through various papers and sort of doing fundamental research in the area of paleoclimate, past climate, that he had correctly described what a lot of scientists had not yet put together about the way climate changes at the end of an ice age. And we have to remember that for the past 3 million years, Earth has been in a really unusual state. During this time, it has oscillated back and forth between periods of intense glaciation, which have lasted 100,000 years or more, and then these brief periods of called interglacials, which are about 15,000 years long, where it reaches a point, usually toward the end of an interglacial, where there's no, at least the North Polar Cap is gone. It's all water. And then there's a mysterious change, and it's quite abrupt, and another ice age begins. And I put this together piece by piece, and all of the scientific literature was in place. Just nobody had ever connected the dots. So Art and I were talking about it, and he said, you know, well, why don't we do a book about it? And so we wrote Superstorm together. And we went out, and of course we were just laughed off the stage by people like Matt Lauer, because they'd never heard of anything like this before.
Well, the premise being that the abrupt change, a deep freeze, could happen, boom, like that,
in a month. Yeah, it could go from one climate to another. In the movie, it was like a week, but in the book, it's more like a month or 2 months. And that was what we saw. But we found things. This amazing work done by a professor from the Bird Polar Research Institute, a wonderful, fascinating guy called Lonnie Thompson, where he has gone down into to the core, to the foundations of glaciers all through the Peruvian Andes, and has found deciduous temperate zone plants under these glaciers, frozen so quickly that their cells are still intact. They're like frozen food in that sense. They're not frozen slowly, so that they are all wilted like they would, on a farm or in your backyard garden. They're frozen so suddenly that the cells are intact. Like, you know, you open frozen food and it's all still looks fresh, meaning that they froze almost instantaneously. They were flash frozen. Nobody knows the mechanism of that. But we do now know, and this has now become much more scientifically valid, since the Master of the Key made these statements about how this happened, a group of scientists working in northern Germany a few years ago did cores in some ancient lakes. And they determined that the last time climate change occurred on this scale in Germany was the beginning of after the last ice age warmed up, and then there came a period that paleoclimatologists and geologists call the Younger Dryas, where it suddenly got very cold again. They determined that this change took place in that lake over a 30-day period. It went from one climate, very much like this, to a completely untenable, freezing climate, and it stayed like that for 2,000 years.
What did this guy tell you that led you to believe he was warning that we could be facing something like that real soon?
Well, he described the way it happened. He described how winds blowing over the northern ocean would melt the polar ice, and how fresh water would come down and flood down into the south into the Atlantic, and how this would stop the Gulf Stream. And when that happened, sudden climate change would be imminent. And right now, there is a huge bolus of fresh water from summer melt off of Greenland and the North Pole polar cap last summer, which it got very warm up there, and there was a huge amount of melt. It's sitting there in the Arctic Ocean. It's not yet enough to start moving south. But if you look at Gulf Stream flows now, and Gulf Stream flows in June, say, of 2004, it's a whole different picture. It was much stronger then than it is now. If that water comes down, we will have what the Master of the Key described. And the result of this will be that, for example, Europe, which is right now the number one producer of wheat in the world, not the number one exporter, we are, but it produces more wheat than any other. That little bit of the world, just that little bit of Europe, is so productive, that production would end. And when it did, right now, people all across the world are restless, especially in the Middle East, because they're not getting enough food, and food prices are too high for them to afford. that would become an extraordinary worldwide phenomenon under those circumstances, and that could happen next year.
His implication is that billions of people could die soon.
Absolutely. Absolutely, and that's a correct implication. You know, there's people say, oh, global warming is nonsense. It's all a fantasy. I even get letters from people explaining to me that carbon dioxide isn't a greenhouse gas and so on and so forth. I don't really care about that. I'm not even interested in it, whether or not I'm not interested in it from a political standpoint. And the reason is nature is numbers. In nature, 2 and 2 never equals 4.3 or 3.9 ever. It's always 4. And if there is another season of melt this summer, as dramatic as there was last summer, and so far the Arctic air mass is holding, it's not getting colder. I mean, it's not getting hotter than it should be. It's normal. It's not normal farther south, God knows. In most of the United States, it's terribly hot. But in the Arctic, it's holding okay. If that happens again, and there's more methane pouring out into the atmosphere than there as there was last summer, then this whole shift could take place.
It makes you wonder why he's telling you this, and you raised that question. Why didn't he go to David Deutsch or Stephen Hawking? Why is he telling me this? Because, as you mentioned, you get letters about the word global warming, and people get into a furor. Over their position, whether or not humans are contributing to it or not, this could happen independently of whether we're responsible for it or not.
Even the question, we should have been planning for this for a long time without regard to our participation in it, for the simple reason that if we look back over the climate, it's happened half a dozen times at least that we can identify, and it has always happened about 15,000 years after an ice age, another ice age just started. It's been 15,000 years since the last ice age ended. We should have been really looking into that, and we did not do it. And with regard to global warming, the saddest thing is the area where denial of those climactic realities is strongest in the world is across the southwestern and southeastern United States. This is the center of that political movement. This is also going to be, and already is, the first area of the Western Hemisphere to really take a hit from climate change. Right now, as we speak, there are fires burning in Arizona, largest fire so far ever in the history of that state. Fires breaking out in Texas, the worst drought they've ever known in Texas, my homeland. And believe me, my family's suffering down there in the ranching business and so on and so forth, unbelievably. And then meanwhile in the southeast, the tornadoes are horrifying. And this is all due to this climactic disruption that the same people who live there don't believe is happening.
Huge snow melt on the Colorado, flooding in Nebraska and along the Mississippi. I mean, people say, global warming can't be happening. Look at all the snowstorms we had last winter. Well, you know, something is clearly going on.
Something is wrong. But there, you know, it's a really, really interesting situation. One thing that he did not predict that is apparently going to happen is NASA announced last week that they think that the next solar cycle, the next solar max due to start in 2020, is not going to happen. That the sun is instead of that is going to go into something a solar minimum, and the last solar minimum is associated with the so-called Little Ice Age, and it might be that the sun is going to save our necks just in the nick of time, hopefully. Maybe we'll get a reprieve.
And does him telling you this, is it for purposes of, hey, come on, get up and get moving and get ready for this thing? Or is it a foregone conclusion that there isn't much we can do, that billions of people will die regardless?
I don't think that was his expectation. I've wondered always that why I ended up in this position, because I'm not the right person I seem to me to be the exact wrong person. I mean, here I am, a horror novelist, and I write a book about called Communion, which is worse, scarier than any horror novel, and claim that it's real. How believable is that? It's not. It is not believable. And yet, it's true. But why me? Why not Stephen Hawking? Why not some great scientist, someone who could say with authority that this happened? Instead, it's a guy off, you know, kind of a sideline individual whose credibility can easily be questioned. I just don't get it.
I think the answer, Whitley, is that you would that you could be relied on to go ahead and say it.
Maybe that was it. But like the master of the key, one thing is true: I was able to remember what he said, and I was willing to try my best to get the message out there. And maybe the other people who are in positions of authority would never have dared to do that for fear of ruining their careers.
Let's talk about for a couple of minutes, and then we'll take a break, but about something that people can maybe get their heads around a little easier, and that's some of the topics you've dealt with before: aliens, visitors, abductions. You asked him about those things. What did he tell you?
Well, he was saying that, you know, that it's not all pretty out there, that there are things going on that we are the victims of exploitation. And yeah, I felt that very definitely, that in my own experience, it was a real mixture of the most incredible education you could possibly imagine and pretty much exploitation. I mean, because, God, I mean, that night in December of 1985, I was sexually molested. It's as simple as that. There's no other way to describe it. You know, I've been laughed at for years about this so-called rectal probe because I was too reticent to say it. It took me 20 years even to say to my wife, I was raped on that night. I can say it now publicly, but it took a long time, a long time. I'm still being treated for the injuries that were so severe. And that's exploitation, in my opinion. And yet later, when I became so compulsive about it and began compulsively going out in the woods in the middle of the night, which was insane. I mean, given what had happened to me, I don't, to this day, I can't fully explain why I did that. And yet, there was a response that you can read in the other books after Communion. And you will read more about in this book that's coming out in January, Solution to the Communion Enigma, which I've written. It took me 10 years to write this. That it was an incredible education I received. It culminated in the key. It was as if everything that happened to me from 1986 through 1995 or 1996, when it's pulled back, was preparation for that night in 1998, so that I would be able to understand this man well enough to put down in writing what he said. I think that's what my whole life has been about, frankly, this book, The Key.
And along the way, in addition to the alien encounters, the visitors, whatever you want to call them, in subsequent years, you've started communicating or experiencing things like dead people. And that also fits into this scenario. We'll get into that, the whole discussion of souls, alien visitors, all of that and a lot more with Whitley Strieber, author of The Key, when we come back here on Coast to Coast AM.